Hello and welcome to Baird's IPO Reboot Series. I'm Tom Shadwald. I'm a director on Baird's Equity Capital Markets Desk based in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Baird's hosting the IPO Reboot Series this year for executives looking to learn the ABCs of the going public process. On today's episode number 4, we're going to be speaking about drafting the offering documents. And I'm delighted today to be joined by David Goldschmidt from Skadden. David, do you mind introducing yourself?
Sure. It's a pleasure to be here, Tom. I run the Global Capital Markets Group at Skadden. We're a worldwide firm, as some of you may know, with capital markets practices, both, not only in North America, but also significant practices in Asia and in Europe. We're over probably 125, almost 150 lawyers worldwide working on all different types of capital market transactions. And it's a pleasure to be here.
Great. Thank you, David. So we're going to run this as a little bit of a moderated panel here. So I'm going to go through some questions with David. We'll keep it a little informal. So I think maybe the first place to start is if you just give us a quick overview of some of the primary documents that need to be drafted as part of the IPO process and kind of the relative timing of each and where's the starting place for most issuers?
Yeah, so I think, the primary document, as most of you will know, is the S-1 or the prospectus, which is the offering document that gets filed with the SEC, which is used to hand out to investors in order to make their decisions. So that takes a significant amount of work and collaborative effort by the company, their lawyers, underwriters, and their lawyers, accountants, and sometimes PR people to make that document work both as a selling document, but most importantly, it's a liability document. It is the document where you describe the company, you gotta describe it accurately with no material omissions or misstatements, because heaven forbid, if there is a lawsuit, that is gonna be the primary source of the litigation. But in addition to that document, the IPO is really the company's coming out party, so to speak. And so this is the time where it has to get other documents, use other documents to get the company ready to be a public offering, And that could be corporate restructuring. That's the financial statements, needs 3 years of financial statements or 2 years of financial statements, depending on the size of the company, audited typically by one of the large accounting firms. And that takes a significant amount of time and effort, and they have to be SEC compliant. And so also the other parts of the primary document, so to speak, or work stream would be sort of tax planning, restructuring, where the company should be domiciled. Are there any things that need to be done in advance of taking the company public? Because once you take a company public, it's a lot more difficult to do all these types of transactions.
Great. I think that kind of dovetails into one of the next questions I had on my agenda here, which is what are kind of the key sections of that prospectus, which obviously is the main document for the offering? Where do folks usually start? Are there certain areas that have a longer lead time? And kind of who holds the pen on each section? Because I know there's a lot of folks involved, obviously, in the IPO process. Bankers, lawyers, auditors. So maybe if you could just give us the quick overview there.
So the question of who holds the pen is an interesting one and varies from deal to deal, depending on who knows the company well, who has the bandwidth to do that. So I'd like to look at an S-1 prospectus, which could be 150 pages long, detailed document in various different buckets. The first one is obviously what we call the business section, description of the business, what it does, what its plans are, what its strategy is, what its history, who customers are, how it sells its product, sales and marketing, regulation, all these different chapters. And they're prescribed by the SEC what types of items need to be disclosed. But again, it's very bespoke to the company that, again, back to my what I said earlier, you can't have any material omissions or misstatements. So if something doesn't fit squarely into the SEC rules, but it's very important to the business of the company, you got to describe it. So you have a very, very voluminous business description, which is one bucket. And that takes a lot of time and a lot of massaging and a lot of input, both lawyers, bankers, and the company, obviously, to make sure that it is there are no ambiguities, and it's very clear and concise description of the company, how it makes money, how it sells its products, what its strategies are, what its strengths are, and so on and so forth. So that's one bucket. The second bucket is the company's financial performance. And that what I talked about earlier, you need the company's financial statements, both income statement, balance sheet, statement of cash flows, and notes to financial statements, which are prepared by the company with the accountants and audited by the accountants and independent. But hand in glove with the financial statements is what everyone calls, or what is called, the MD&A, the Management's Discussion Analysis of the Financial Condition, which is a year-by-year analysis of, or in any interim period analysis of, the company's results of operation from one quarter to the next, or from one year to the previous year. And in addition to that, you have a whole discussion on the company's liquidity needs, how it's funded its operations previously, whether it will have enough funding to go forward for the next what period of time, whether if it has debt obligations, the description of those debt obligations, the maturities, and so on and so forth. So that financial history, although dovetails well with the business section, it's really, it's also a standalone section. And to that part is very much the company's finance arm working with lawyers to help to describe the company's financial side. A third bucket is what we call the risk factors, which is really a description of what investors should know about, what the risks are to the business. And what we'd like to say is that companies should throw everything into the risk factors. The more you put into the risk factors, the better you are to defend yourself. And something goes wrong and somebody says, why didn't you tell me this? But you need to put in the material risk factors. You need to describe why they are a risk and what could happen to the company if certain risks materialize. You know, obviously supply chain was a big issue back in COVID times, may still be some supply issue risks, energy risks, but every company, interest rate risks right now, but every company has very generic risks about the economy and market. But the SEC is really getting into the very specific risks that are applied to this company. So that's the third bucket. The fourth bucket is the compensation disclosure. And that is, as time has gone on and how the market has focused on compensation, those disclosures have gotten more detailed. And frankly, companies prior to going through an IPO process typically revamps their whole compensation structure, their long-term compensation structure. And that has to be described in detail, both historically, what you've done in the past, and prospectively, what the company's plans are for the future. And the reason why companies put these plans in place now is that once you're public, you need shareholder approval to do such a thing. And getting those approvals now when you're a private company is far easier. And investors want to see those types of plans in place so they get no surprises later on. Plus, most importantly, they want to see that company's management and rank and file have the proper economic incentives to work very hard and grow the company. So I would say, you know, those four legs of the chair are the primary. I would add to that, there's the whole part of describing the company's organization and making sure its charter and bylaws and all sorts of things like that. Its corporate policies are all set in place, and they also have to be described in the prospectus.
I think another thing that companies kind of hear about as they head down the IPO path is the concept of the box, which is that section up front that kind of quickly summarizes in 15 to 20 pages kind of each of the detailed sections that David described and follows kind of that initial summary.
Right. And what I'd like to do when preparing for an IPO is I'd like the company to start with the large business section, get that, get the thoughts and get what the describe the business. And then you cut and paste from that business section and put that into the box because the boxes, people watching this probably know, is the teaser. That, you know, if investors read the box and they say this looks interesting, then they're going to start delving into the prospectus in detail. If the box doesn't give them that sizzle or interest for whatever reason, they'll go on to the next deal that comes onto their desk.
Yeah, that's a great practical point in terms of kind of how to think about the sequencing of each section as you work through it in real time. Maybe shifting topics, I think the investor presentation as part of the broader drafting kind of happens in parallel with the prospectus drafting, but there are some kind of footfalls that folks may want to be aware of as it relates to kind of changing that presentation and getting it up to the sniff test of kind of public disclosure in markets versus private markets. I don't know, David, if you had any advice for companies around kind of what some of those common footfalls may be and what they should kind of be thinking about in terms of the presentation that needs to be drafted for investors.
Yeah, one of the things that companies have been doing, they always have presentations. Their presentations since, they were doing their, Series A round, they've had presentations that keep evolving as their business plan evolves, as their investors morph and get larger and so on and so forth. So there is an evolution to deck, so to speak. And I'd like to think about the decks. There are really two decks. There's one deck that companies present to the investment bankers who are going to work on the deal. And that is a deep dive, and to analysts. And that is a deep dive on this company. And they're really in there educating the company or educating the bankers, the lawyers on the details of the company. And that is a deck and huge, and nothing should be spared. Everything should go in that deck. But then you need a deck for when you go out to investors. And the rule of thumb, not the rule of thumb is, but the rule is anything that you say in the deck needs to be A, of course, factually accurate, and B, needs to be tied back into the prospectus or generally publicly knowledge information. So you can't say, we're not going to say this in the prospectus, but when we talk to investors, we're going to tell them, for example, our growth rate for the next 5 years is going to be 30%, but we're not going to say that in the prospectus. You can't do that. If you're going to promise something in the investor deck, you got to tie it back to the prospectus as well. You can't have two different selling types of documents. And the deck to investors has to be pithy, sort of like a 20-minute elevator pitch, capturing the highlights of the company, the central thesis of why it's a good investment, highlighting its business, highlighting its management, highlighting its historical growth and what its strategy is for the future, not giving out projections because we don't, in the US, we don't put out projections when we're selling securities. I like to say it's the, for those of us who are old enough, it's the dragnet of business, just the facts, ma'am, just the facts. You tell everybody what you've done. And you give KPIs, the same type of information you would give, for example, in a prospectus. And again, roadshow presentations could be, 20, 30 minutes long at a luncheon with sometimes one-on-ones with companies or investors who get more into the details. but often not. That the investor presentation is all what people may hear from management without reading the prospectus. So it has to be tight and a standalone presentation.
Maybe just shifting topics a little bit, and you touched on some of these in some of your initial comments when you're talking about the prospectus, but what other sort of internal company or third-party agreements would you highlight for executives to be aware of? I know you commonly hear things like lockup agreements. If there's any of those that require kind of the eyeballs of management that you'd highlight here.
Yeah, so this is also, as I said, it's the company's debut. And so if there are, you know, let's work it from, you know, are there commercial agreements that are we need to button up, the company needs to button up, maybe renew, maybe get them long term, maybe to, if there's an argument, get that resolved. So there are some long-term material business commercial agreements that need to be buttoned up. You don't want to have them loose or go away after you go public, unless you've provided for it. So that those are the one types of business agreements that you got to get buttoned up. Second is with your management. You may need contracts, employment agreements, you know, lock up your key employees. So that's the second one. And with that, hand in glove is what we talked about before, is long-term incentive compensation. Then the next level is your capital base, meaning how have you raised money in the past? Have you raised it through pure equity, preferred debt? And we need to have a good understanding of what happens to all the company types of securities upon an IPO. Does the preferred stock convert into equity? At so what ratios? What will the capital structure of this company look like after it goes public? Will it have preferred? Will it have debt? What kind of debt? Is it asset-based lending? Is it general debt? Is it convertible debt? All those things need to be buttoned up. Nothing has to be all converted in equity, but the company has to have a very, very, very rational capital structure to take it to the next stage of growth. And so if it needs more debt, well, this is the time to negotiate debt instruments. You mentioned, Tom, lockup agreements. You know, one of the key elements of going public is it's a liquidity event. It's a liquidity event for the company to raise capital. But it's also a time for shareholders to have liquidity as well. And you want to temper that liquidity, meaning perhaps deal is strong enough that it could afford to have insiders sell shares in the IPO. But quite often than not, investors don't want to see insiders trading at selling out at an IPO, even if it's a small portion. And they want them to have skin in the game and be locked up for some period of time. 180 days, maybe longer, maybe staggered, so on and so forth. And you need all those types of agreements with shareholders. Hopefully, when you did your private raise, you've thought about all those issues and you have those people already committed that they'll have to sign up a lockup. But if they're not committed and you have to go get them to sign a lockup, sometimes those conversations can be very difficult because they'll say, what's in it for me? Why should I lock up?
Yeah, that's a great point. And maybe kind of shifting to today, like, are there any recent trends you're seeing as it relates to documentation? I know there are a lot of companies that were on file publicly and they've been updating those filings as a regular course of business, but any perspective on some things companies should be thinking about who maybe were gearing up for an IPO a year or two ago and are just now kind of re-gearing up? Anything on the risk factor front? Anything, any good tidbits like that?
Well, I guess with respect to risk factors, again, a couple of years ago, supply chain was significant issues. We're now living in a rising interest rate environment. There are geopolitical headwinds, depending on your business. The interest rates effect on commercial real estate, for example, as well as debt coverage and higher expenses. We're seeing changes in the workforce, which is seeing changes in ESG issues. All those things come to a forefront in an IPO and have to be addressed. So you see things like that, and as far as the risk factors are concerned, obviously in the last several weeks, we saw a rash of risk factors with respect to the banking sector, and time will tell what happens there. We'll still see, obviously, risk factors on COVID and its impact on international travel, business travel, the movement and goods of things like that, and the like as the economy is changing.
Yeah. And then maybe like to wrap up the conversation, I generally like to ask kind of one overarching question, and the answer doesn't need to be limited to just today's topic on documentation, David, but if you were to give kind of three pieces of advice to a company thinking about going public, what would those be?
So going public is, if you ask any entrepreneur, may have gone public, sold his business, bought businesses, they will tell you that the IPO is one of the most exhilarating pieces of business experiences that they've all had, because it is a culmination of a lot of years of hard work to grow a business, and then a lot of months, if not years, of getting a company ready to go public. So with that, it also comes with great expense. You're hiring lawyers, you're hiring underwriters, you're hiring accountants, you may be hiring IR people, you're gearing up internally. So before you do that, you need to be ready. You know, companies who have fits and starts, they want to go public, they're not sure, they start, they stop, they start, they start, and stop again. It's a recipe for disaster, both on the expense and the momentum. So my view always has been, get a company prepared to go public, go get your financial statements, go get your lawyers, go get your accountants, speak to a lot of bankers, get input, but when it's, and speak to your board and your shareholders and your other stakeholders, and make sure you have buy-in. You don't have to get everyone's sign off on every I that's dotted and T that's crossed, but you need to get a commitment that everyone is ready to embark on this journey. And once you decide that, then you're really pushing forward and you're putting the pedal to the metal to drive it to completion, because what we have found, and which everyone finds, if you stop the momentum and then restart it, it takes a while to restart, and it's expensive to restart, and you lose, and it's not a great efficient process. So that, I think, is one: commitment, get your stakeholders on board, and drive the process to fruition. Second, think about your board. You know, people, I find executives always nervous, you know, don't want to, you know, jinx the process by thinking about outside directors, and they don't know who to ask, and they ask lawyers and bankers and so on for recommendations, which is all good things to do. But I've always found, you know, good board members are really important. And it's easy to put someone on a board. It's really hard to get a bad person off a board. It takes time. So give it thought, get independent people. They don't identify them, get them to understand the business, get them for you to figure out how they could help you run your business, because they're there to help you, not just help sell the deal, but after the deal is sold, but help you run the business, and whose counsel you admire, and they have some expertise that you could use to help round out the management team. So I really urge people to give a lot of thought to board members. And then I think the last thing is just remember, you know, the day after you go public, you're now a public company. You know, You got to answer to public shareholders. You have to answer to regulators. You have to answer to the press sometimes. You have to ask to activists. You have to answer to short sellers. It is a whole new world. And you got to be prepared for it. And there is a mindset that changes once you move from being a private company, even if you're owned by VC members or private equity firms. It's a big difference than when you become a public company.
I think we'll leave it there. That's excellent advice. I too many times find myself talking about that public mindset shift that you really need to start thinking about as early on in your IPO kind of process. And so I'd like to say thanks again to David for sharing his time with us today. If you'd like to get a hold of myself or David, you can find our contact information on our respective company's website. Thanks for joining today's session. We'll leave it there. Thanks, David.
My pleasure, Tom. Thank you very much for including me.